up until now, we have been looking exclusively at the Eastern Mediterranean. And today we'll start looking to see what the Western Mediterranean is like. As of about the 4th century B.C., there are, in fact, three major powers in the Western Mediterranean. The most important of these powers is the state of Carthage, which has already created an empire which extends along the North African coast and includes southern Spain and the eastern coast, or the Mediterranean coast, of most of Spain. Carthage itself is essentially a commercial empire founded by the Phoenicians, who had been merchants. They continued this pattern. They tended to be relatively harsh overlords to subject cities and peoples, and they were accustomed to using mercenary troops in their armies, that is, not using their own inhabitants except as the leaders. The second major power are that series of Greek city-states that exist in the west. In Sicily, where the major city and one of the richest Greek cities is Syracuse, and in southern Italy are a series of them, Taranto, Naples, Cumae, so on, and of course Marseille or Massilia up on the coast of southern France. The third major empire are the mysterious Etruscans. Now, the Etruscans are a people we know very little about. They seem to have come into central Italy sometime around the 9th century, and probably from Asia Minor. Probably, in fact, moving out when there was a shortage of food supplies, and coming into that area of central Italy, that is, the area that lies north of Rome. They founded a series of city-states and, in fact, seemed to have subjugated the native population. Now, the Etruscans then formed a league of city-states, and, indeed, then they began to move south and to take over more territory and more cities, practically down to Naples itself. So that these are the three major powers. Now, all of them are sea powers to a degree. But as sea powers went, by far the most important were the Carthaginians. Indeed, the Carthaginians boasted that they owned the Western Mediterranean so intensely that no one could wash their hands in it without asking Carthaginian permission. And surely, in the 4th century or the 5th century, if you had had to guess which would become the major power, or who would become the major power in the Western Mediterranean, the last place anyone would have picked would have been that miserable little town called Rome. Because Rome, as of this date, is a genuine zilch. The traditional founding date of Rome is the 8th century. But that is rather beside the point. Early Rome was simply a cluster of mud and brush huts up on the Palatine Hill. Now, the Palatine Hill is not as large as the UCLA campus, and there seem to have been four tiny little villages of grubby little huts up there. And the only importance to Rome was that this was the first place up the river where you could negotiate a crossing of the river Tiber. And this was, in fact, its strategic importance. The early Romans, as far as we know anything about them, seem to have been farmers raising grubby crops, turnips they were fond of, and a rather wretched kind of grain called spelt. And they lived in wretched little one-room houses with a hearth and only a door and a hole at the top for the smoke to get out, so that they were a horrid little group, totally. Indeed, neighboring them to the south, up on the hills, the Alban Hills, were slightly larger towns, but nothing very special there either. And when the Etruscans made their move to the south, they took over this entire area, including this wretched little village of Rome, and they seem to have installed kings or some type of governor that ruled this little clutch of persons on the Palatine Hill. And there they remained until finally there were rebellions against the Etruscans, in part spearheaded by the Greek cities to the south and to other tribes like the Samnites, who joined in with the Latins, and the Etruscans were driven out. The traditional date is 509. Now, when they're driven out of this little grubby town of Rome, you start the Roman Republic. And indeed, the one thing that through history the Romans were determined about was never to be ruled by a king again. Ever, ever, ever. And it was to play something of a role in future Roman history, in fact. Instead, they began the formation of a rather complex kind of government with elected officials, which included two consuls as the heads of the state, and an advisory body called the Senate. Underneath this was a general assembly. And this is, you understand, a very small kind of city-state. Now, it ruled the immediate territory around the Palatine Hill, and it controlled the river crossings, and it also controlled some salt pans down close to the Mediterranean. This was one of their major sources for trade, because, in fact, they didn't make anything to trade at all. If anything, they went somewhat backward from Etruscan days. And their first struggle was indeed against the towns up in the Alban Hills. And they were finally successful. We needn't go into the legends of this, which seem unlikely. They were successful in defeating the Latin towns and becoming the head of a so-called Latin League. Now, this gave them control of the territory to all of 30 miles south of Rome, and nothing very splendid. There was a growth of huts, and the town grew up some. The people of Rome at this time are divided into two basic groups. There are the patricians, and the patricians are the good families who seem to have known who their parents were. This is the essential group, and underneath these are the plebeians. Now, the plebeians may, in fact, represent other conquered tribes in the immediate vicinity of Rome itself, but the patricians had legal rights, and plebeians did not. Plebeians were not represented in the government, and if they wanted to take a case to law, it had to be handled by a patrician. So every head of a patrician family had a group of plebeians who connect themselves with him as clients. And under Roman law, the head of the family is the father. The father owns everything and everybody. It's all very nice and simple. He owns his children outright. He arranges their marriages. He sees to their property. They can't do anything without his say-so. In early days, he has the power of life and death over them. Roman women have rights over their dowries and are indeed perhaps more admired in Rome than they were in Greece. Roman religion tended in its early days to be very simple. Household spirits. That is, there is a divinity of the heart, one of the door, fertility spirits, this kind of thing. In fact, it's a very primitive kind of religion. And they lived a very primitive kind of life here. The first major change took place when the plebeians simply got tired of all of this patrician nonsense and announced that they wanted rights and a share in the government. And when the patricians said, oh, no, 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 none of that, the plebeians simply got up and said, all right, we'll just simply go away and found our own city. And the hell with you. And they did. They all marched right out of Rome, went several miles away, and sat down there. What turned out to be one of the most successful sit-down strikes in history. Because, in fact, the Roman patricians gave in. And they decided that one of the two leaders of the Roman state, this is a consulship, an elected official, C-O-N-S-U-L, hereafter could be a plebeian. And had to be from a plebeian family. The plebeians were also given the right to elect two special officials called tribunes. Tribunes represented the plebeians always with the government. Tribunes had, well, they were very special persons, and it was against the law not just to kill a tribune, but even to physically attack a tribune. This is a death offense. The tribune also has the power to veto any law which is against plebeian interests, and he can, in fact, take away from the government plebeian prisoners accused of crimes until he can take care of this and see about it himself. In other words, they are protectors of the plebeians within the state itself. So from this time on, as you can see, the plebeians are going to have a share in the government, and in fact, as time passes, the situation will be that one consul has to be a plebeian and the other consul can be a plebeian. However, the great advisory body of Rome is the Senate. And the Senate is normally made up of patricians and those persons who have held high office in the state, which does get a certain number of plebeians into the senatorial body as well. Ex-consuls are always members of the Senate. Law is handled primarily by what is called a proconsul, and the proconsul usually established, when he is appointed, what laws he will uphold. And this eventually becomes a kind of Roman law code. In other words, some laws had become out of date, and the proconsuls will no longer maintain those laws. So you have them established as judges. In addition to this, every 5 years, there was a censor appointed who took a census of the state and indeed checked to see whether people could have the right to sit in the Senate, forms of this nature. And in time of dire trouble, time of war, the Romans could appoint a dictator. And the dictator would take over control of all governmental activities. He is usually appointed for not more than 6 months, and it is normal at the end of that period for him to simply relinquish that position all through this period. So this is the basic format of the Roman state of this time when it is still not very important. Now by the 4th century, Rome, indeed, is in control of this small area. It has also attacked the nearest and the small Etruscan city and defeated it. And just when things looked better for Rome, trouble came down from the north. This was in the form of marauding Gallic tribes that came down from North Italy and proceeded to seize towns, to plunder, hold people for ransom, kill people. And the Gauls were scared. For one thing, they were big. And for another thing, they had very loud voices. And when they went in battle, they all yelled at the top of their lungs, "I'm a runt on you." And they did this on Rome. Well, the Romans freaked straight out. Most of the Romans simply got the hell out of the way and out of town, zappa. And a few stayed on the Capitol Hill. The rest fled to Veii and stayed there. They seem to have had to ransom the city from the Gauls. After the Gauls left, they decided they'd build a wall in case the Gauls ever came back, and Rome becomes a walled city now. But in the course of that Gallic invasion, they had lost control of even the Latins up in the Alban Hills. So they had to start from scratch. Rome gets off to a very slow start, as you can see. So they went out and they went to war with the Alban League, and they conquered them again, and they regained control of that territory. Fine. And the next thing that happens is that some of the Greek cities to the south asked for Roman aid against the Samnite tribes in the hills. And the Romans, after much consultation in the Senate, decided to go along. And this involved them in no less than three wars against the Samnites. Now, believe me, I'm not going through all the Roman wars, war by war. I simply want to point out what happens in these Samnite wars to typify how the Romans operate. Because the Romans are defeated in the Samnite War, and they are forced to accept subjection, to walk underneath the yoke, and this ends the First War. Now, the Romans are always going to be the same historically for a very long time. They cannot accept defeat. The Romans are going to be among the most tenacious people we know in history. No matter how bad the defeat, they then went back to Rome, they gathered together new armies, new people, and then they went back to fight it out again. And in the long run, they defeat the Samnites. Now, once they've defeated the Samnites, in fact, all they're interested in, basically, is making alliances with the Samnites, as they had with the Latin cities. And the kind of alliance that is made is a fairly simple one. It's made from center to center. And there were such things as Latin rites, and now when they defeat the Samnites, what are called Italic or Italian rites. These meant that both cities promised to support each other in case of attack, and that in case Rome was in war, the allied city is made to send or promise a certain amount of aid in terms of men, supplies, and so on. In addition to this, it may or may not have the right of intermarriage between the inhabitants of the two centers, and also market rights or trade rights between the two. Now, these are the basic kinds of rights that are involved. Aside from this, the Romans do not try to set up control over the Samnite cities. And this becomes then a kind of basic process by which Rome expands. In a rather casual way, indeed. Because from here, Rome will eventually move down and take over basic control of the Greek states in southern Italy and over the Etruscan cities in central Italy to the north. Again, constantly making these alliances and then letting the cities go their own way. What it means is basically this: that Rome retained control of what we would call foreign affairs and allowed the other towns to have total control of internal or local affairs. This is the basic establishment. Now, when Rome has reached this point, which is by the beginning of the 3rd century, this has worked to the advantage of almost all of the conquered areas because it has ensured peace internally within most of Italy, and it has opened up new areas for commercial operations for all the member states of this expanding Roman Republic. None of the persons allied, however, can vote for Roman officers or participate in the Roman government. And indeed, in conquered territories, after a conquest, very often portions of land were taken over and were given out to Roman citizens. And Roman citizens, persons with that citizenship, begin to expand. But they can only vote if they come to the city of Rome. Now, the city of Rome, throughout all of this period, and this will take us up to 265 BC, is still not producing anything. Rome is never a commercial or an industrial state. It is a center, increasingly, of government, and it is also still unbelievably grubby and little. The buildings are still built of brick or a very bad porous kind of stone called tufa. They are still eating turnips and spelt. They have not found out anything about gourmet food as yet. They're still living in miserable houses. Indeed, on one occasion here, a Carthaginian ambassador comes to Rome to visit. And he's, of course, entertained at all of the best patrician houses. But he can't help noticing that he seems to be being served at dinner, at every dinner, off the same set of silver. And that's right, because there's only one set in all of Rome. And whoever's giving the party gets to use it. In other words, though Rome is by now something of a power, it is hardly what you would call wealthy or splendid as of this period. Now, I use the cutoff date of 265 B.C. because this is the beginning of the Punic Wars, that is, the wars against Carthage. And the wars against Carthage again arise in an almost haphazard fashion. There is a city to the north of Syracuse in Sicily, somewhat of a robber city, in fact, that was under attack by Syracuse, and it sent embassies to Rome to ask the Romans to support them. Now, the Romans weren't at all sure what the hell was going on in Sicily, and the Senate sat down and debated, where is Sicily? Has anyone ever heard of this town? What's it like? Do you think we should support them? And they continue to argue and talk. No one really knows much about this. In the meantime, the town sent also to the Carthaginians and asked them to support them. Finally, the Roman Senate decided to send troops to support this town. And they arrived almost simultaneously with the Carthaginians. And what happened then was the war broke out between the Carthaginians and the Romans. Now, this presented an enormous amount of difficulty because the Carthaginians ruled the sea. And the Romans knew absolutely nothing about boats, but nothing. So there was no way of getting over to Carthage except by sea. You couldn't even get to Sicily without a boat as far as that went. So they had to try to build a navy. And the Romans, as I've explained to you, are always going to go seriously to work on problems. They find a Carthaginian warship which has been beached out of a storm, and it is complete. Now, this gives them the model with which to build boats. And they do understand that boats have to be rowed. But, of course, no Romans know how to row a boat either. So they build some kind of rowing stalls in a lake, and they get Romans together, and they sit them down at the oars, and they explain, now, you all have to do it at the same time, and we all sit and we practice rowing and rowing together. But they still don't really know how to run boats. So they build themselves a navy. Fine. They're going to go out against the greatest naval power in the Western Mediterranean. And they don't really know how to fight a naval battle at all. What they do know about is fighting land battles, right? So they're not dumb, these Romans. What they do is to arrange on the boats, up by the mast, because the ships all have masts, a very long pole which has a great big spike on the end of it. And what they did was to row over close to the Carthaginian ships when they meet in battle, drop this thing, which spikes the Carthaginian ship to them, then they fight a land battle. In fact, it is an extraordinary kind of improvisation. And to everyone's astonishment, they beat the socks off the Carthaginians. You've never heard of this sort of maneuver at all. So, they do, as a result of all of this, win the first war against the Carthaginians. Now, this gives them Sicily, all of Sicily. And Sicily is going to prove a revelation to the Romans. Again, they make alliances with some cities, but the whole island has to have something special done with it. So it becomes the first Roman province. And for the first time, conquered persons now are going to pay taxes to help support the Roman navy, the Roman army, the Roman state. And a Roman governor will now be sent in to rule the province of Sicily. This is the beginning, then, of a more imperial form of expansion. The second thing they find down there is lots of well-educated and rich Greeks, particularly in Syracuse. And the Romans become enamored of Greek culture at this time. It's the beginning of the Hellenizing of the Romans. They take up Greek literature, all of these things, and more than that, they discover that in Syracuse there were cooks. Well, that is a real revelation to the Romans. For the first time, there are sauces and special things to do with fish, and it is a whole vast revelation. Now, this is going to be important culturally to the later history of Rome, because no matter what you see on the TV shows or late movies at night, if there is one great Roman vice, it is not sex, it is eating. Once the Romans found out about good food, they take to it with an unadulterated passion beyond belief and beyond any other people in history. In Roman slave markets, you could get 10 top-class dancing girls for the price of one really good chef. First things first, kid. The stomach comes first with the Romans. The Romans, in due time, will develop the dinner to such a degree that they are the only persons, I believe, in the history of the world who invented that exquisite small room called the vomitorium off the dining room. You simply eat as much as you can hold, and then you retire, and you tickle the back of your throat with a burnt feather. You lose that whole dinner. Then you go back and begin again and eat another one. Now, this is what I mean when I say their great vice is food. No other people have gone near that. It is extraordinary. Now, this they began to learn also from the Greeks. And indeed, the Greeks will be culturally all important to the Romans. Okay. So they have now founded a first province. They have defeated Carthage. And Carthage is, of course, living. Carthage gathers its forces together. There is one all-important Carthaginian family which swears for vengeance against Rome for this. And that family will eventually see the birth of one Hannibal. And Hannibal is in Spain. And there are problems that break out again between Rome and the Carthaginians. And Hannibal decides on that extraordinary venture with the backing of Carthage that marks the Second Carthaginian War. That war ends, incidentally, in 201 BC. Hannibal leads his army across southern France and over the Alps down into the Po Valley. It is true that there are elephants with him at this time, but they're not to be of much importance. They are more picturesque than anything else here, nor are they, in fact, the first elephants the Romans have seen. They saw some earlier than this in southern Italy with the hills. And most of those elephants perished, but later more elephants are ferried over from Carthage to join his army. Okay, he arrives in the lush Po Valley. And there he defeats a small Roman troop and crosses down into central Italy. Now, Hannibal's basic assumption is this. He assumes that Rome is an imperial power like Carthage. And he knows a lot about Carthage. And he knows that all the subject cities in the Carthaginian Empire loathe and detest Carthage. That if any foreign army came around, they would not only open their gates, they would happily join anyone against the city of Carthage. He assumes in Italy that it will be this way, that indeed the conquered states and cities of Italy will open their gates to Hannibal and join him against this dreadful monster of Rome. And as he comes south in central Italy, he meets a Roman army and simply demolishes. He captures it between hills and a lake and just totally destroys it. Now he marches on toward Rome itself. But Rome is walled and is strong. And he hasn't any way to successfully lay siege to Rome. What's more, to his astonishment, none of the allied cities of Rome and Italy opened their gates to him or joined him. All gates clanged shut at the sight of Hannibal. Now Hannibal continues on into southern Italy. He's to spend years in Italy, in fact. And when the Romans send another major army against him, he again simply slaughters that entire Roman army. Roman knights would wear a golden ring as a symbol of knighthood. From that particular battle at Cannae, 2 bushel baskets of gold rings from dead knights were sent back to the Senate in Carthage. So that Rome has lost now 2 massive armies. And the next leader, indeed, simply refuses to give battle to Hannibal at all. He simply natters away at the edges of his troops and lets Hannibal troops weaken constantly. They have to live off the countryside. But there seems no way ever to defeat Hannibal. And eventually, the solution is found by a man named Scipio, who is given generalship of an army and who ferries a Roman army right straight across to North Africa to attack Carthage itself. Now, indeed, they lose a lot of shipping in this in a storm, but they still get an army there. And there, just the sort of thing that Hannibal had hoped would happen to him happens with Scipio. The subject cities rise against Carthage, and Hannibal has to be recalled to North Africa to protect Carthage. In the final battle there in 201, Hannibal is finally defeated by Scipio, and Carthage is reduced to a small, almost powerless state, though still wealthy. Its Spanish territory is taken away from it, and this begins the next group of Roman provinces, which will be founded there. So that Rome by now has become a conquering power, and indeed part of this, almost by chance, it seems in none of these to have set out to aggrandize itself in the first place. It is just that if you natter at Rome, Rome will continue to fight till it wins. That's just the way it's going to be. And the result of this is that they get involved now in the Eastern Mediterranean. Because they remember that the Hellenistic empires had split up into a group and that Macedonia was held by the Antigonid family. Now they had come slightly to the support of Carthage. And this involved them with Rome. So Rome now decides to deal with this problem with the Antigonids. Again, it takes a set of wars. And they finally totally defeat the Macedonians and take over that entire section north of Greece. And they free the Greeks from the Macedonians. Now, by this time, and particularly that family of the Scipios, simply adore the Greeks. They think the Greeks are the ones who really know how to do everything. Not just cook, but to write, to keep accounts, to do all kinds of things the Romans are not very good at. And so they hold a special meeting in Greece, and the Roman victor announces to the Greeks that the Greeks finally have their liberty back again. The Greeks applaud. They love it. It's simply marvelous. And the Romans stay around to get things sort of in order and so on. And very shortly, the Romans are very bemused because on all the buildings and street corners are now little chalk signs which say, "Romans, go home." And that seems rude to the Romans, who are simply trying to be helpful here. And it turns out that, in fact, what the Greeks want, now they're free, is to have the freedom to start fighting each other and having their own little wars among themselves. And the Romans keep saying, "No, no, that's not the way you're supposed to do this at all. We didn't free you for this. Now go be cultural. You know, write something. Think. That's what you're supposed to do. Cook. Many of these things. You've got it all wrong." And the Greeks, of course, are simply continually outraged with all this, want the Romans to get the hell out, and so on, and they begin to natter at the Romans and to throw bricks at them and this sort of thing. Very unpleasant. All the way. And this goes on until finally the Romans eventually, in 146, totally lose patience. with this, and they simply send an army into Greece, and they attack the huge, rich city of Corinth and destroy it right down to the ground. Now, that does give the Greeks the idea that there's not going to be any more room for the Greeks to have their natural wars and murders and all the rest of these things. They're going to have to sort of give up and think and cook and be cultural and things like this. Corinth will later be rebuilt. But I might add that in that same year of 146 comes the third and last of the Punic Wars, the wars against Carthage. Carthage had recovered much of its commerce, and there was a man in the Senate in Rome named Cato. And Cato hated Carthage. Cato was also one of these persons who speaks no matter what the subject is. And he ended every speech with the same phrase, no matter what the subject was, taxes, harvest, the weather's awful this season. He ends by Carthago delenda est. Carthage must be destroyed. And, of course, he goes on saying this at the end of every speech until finally the Senate, I guess just to shut him up, is willing to go over and take care of Carthage. It does shut Cato up, too. Because now, in the Third War, 146, they destroy Carthage totally. Carthage is totally torn down. They drive a plow across the site of Carthage and sow the territory with salt so that nothing will ever grow there again. And not too many years later, they found a new city there themselves. So Carthage is reborn from the salt, so to speak, in spite of that. Nonetheless, it ends Carthage, and that whole territory now becomes a new Roman province and a part. Rome, as you can see, is continually expanding. By the time you get to the 2nd century BC, and we're in that century now, some rather odd things happened. Over in Asia Minor, there was a major, very rich kingdom called Pergamum. And Pergamum was a great Greek city which owned quite a lot of territory. But the king and the whole royal line of Pergamum died out. And the last king of Pergamum willed his entire city and state to the Roman Republic. Now, this is a rarity, you must admit, in history, and a somewhat casual treatment, perhaps, of Pergamum itself. When the news was brought to the Roman Senate, the Roman Senate wasn't sure what to do about it. Pergamum? Who's heard of Pergamum? Where is Pergamum? Do we want it? Why should he leave it to us? Is there something sneaky about this? And they argue this and they argue. They argue, would you believe it, for 3 years? Will we take it? Won't we? What did he have in mind? And on they go with this. Until finally, neighbors of the kingdom of Pergamum decide that if Rome doesn't want it, well, they do. And at this point, Rome said, ha! It's ours! So over they go with armies to take care of this. Now the result of this is another long set of wars. This eventually involves them with the Seleucid Empire, Syria, Mesopotamia, and so on. And they end up by conquering all of Asia Minor and then going down and conquering the Seleucid Empire completely. This gives them Mesopotamia for a time being, at least. And not for long. But it gives them Syria, Palestine, this entire area, down to Egypt. The second of the great Hellenistic empires has fallen to them, and the independent kingdoms of Asia Minor. The only one outstanding at this point is Egypt. Egypt is still independent. However, Egypt becomes what is called a client state, which means that it is going to be independent as long as Rome doesn't care and as long as it doesn't make trouble with Rome itself. So that in essence, Rome by this time, that is roughly by the end of the 2nd century BC, have become the rulers of most of the Mediterranean area. it is true, not all. There are sections still in North Africa that it does not rule. The area that is now France, it does not rule, and so on. And Egypt is still technically independent. Nonetheless, this has been an enormous expansion. And the expansion has, in the process, changed Rome itself. Rome has grown to be a large city, and all through this period, Rome has been ruled essentially by the Senate. It's not that the others didn't have rights, but simply because the Senate seemed to be doing everything very well, the Senate just essentially takes control of all of this. What's more, with all of this new territory, Rome has become enormously wealthy. Money has flooded in, and tens and hundreds of thousands of slaves have been taken and have been brought into Rome. Now, or at least into Italy. And this involves the fact that by this time, particularly senatorial families have been buying up huge landed estates in Italy itself. The small farmer is beginning to disappear in favor of large landed estates, and they now begin the process of running these with slave labor. Now, this is, in fact, one of the first times in ancient history that you have slave labor used in large enough numbers to become a major part of the economy of the state. And here it does become, from this time on, a major part of the economy of the Roman state. The so-called latifundias, or huge agricultural estates, are run with slave labor, and they are run very cruelly with slave labor. Romans, indeed, are not very good to their slaves. What's more, the gladiatorial games have been going on, and this now becomes a major passion with the Romans, and of course now slaves are used as gladiators for the sport of Roman citizens. This grows up primarily not so much in Rome itself as down in the south in Capua, in places like this. Rome has only a very small amphitheater itself, and that's built only in the 1st century B.C., in fact. Nonetheless, there is a kind of deterioration of the Roman character going on. The Roman character, Romans in the early stages, had been notable for what is called their virtue, which means their devotion to the state, their devotion to the family, their severity. They begin almost as the Calvinists of ancient history, and they go exquisitely corrupt in this period. They now cheat, lie, steal, kill, all of these nice new things that come along with high civilization and high culture begin to appear in the Roman state. The old virtues go by the boards to a major degree. And the Senate becomes more and more selfish. It is now protecting its own wealth and its own interests. So that corruption steals into Roman government, and to begin to get signs that provincial governors are simply looting their provinces and everything they loot, all of this. This is all in the days of the Republic itself, and not until next time will we get a chance to look at the fateful last days of the Republic, when all the famous figures, Pompey, Julius Caesar, Cleopatra, Virgin, next time round. So,